At the University of Technology in Sydney this week, one of the world's leading experts on democratic innovation asked a question that, in the land of robo-debt, might seem counterintuitive. Can AI save democracy? It's a question that brings together two major tides in global affairs at the moment, the decline of democracy and the rise of artificial intelligence. And the person tackling that question was Professor Beth Novick, director of the Burn Centre for Social Change at Northeastern University. Beth's also an Australian Resilient Democracy Fellow and the author of the new book, Reboot, AI and the Race to Save Democracy. Professor Novick, welcome to Sunday Extra.
Julian, thank you so much for having me.
Now, in Australia, the robo-debt scandal is sort of a byword for tech-enabled bad governance that harms citizens. To counterbalance that, I wonder if you could give us some examples of where AI has, in your view, been used to enhance or improve democracy.
So I think you're absolutely right to phrase it as how we're using AI. AI is just a tool used well. It's a next generation of word processor. It's a next generation of calculator. And to be very clear, AI is actually a basket of different technologies, The worst and most risky and dangerous of which are the kinds of robo-debt predictive tools. Anytime we're trying to use an algorithm to predict, you know, a human behavior is very messy. We don't do a very good job of it. We can barely predict the weather, let alone anything else. But there are other kinds of AI, the kind people are most familiar with, what we call generative AI, ChatGPT, Claude, Gemini, Copilot, the sorts of things that people use in their day-to-day, where we've seen lots of examples of people using these tools to increase efficiency, productivity, and more importantly, to actually improve human engagement. So happy to give a couple of examples that's happening globally and maybe in particular focus, since we're talking about democracy, about the ways in which we're actually using it to amplify and enhance democracy. So it's cities like Hamburg that are going out and saying, how should we improve the way we use our parks? How should we change this derelict land use site? How should we rebuild our city? Going out and asking citizens, getting, of course, thousands of comments and responses, and then using AI to help them sort, organize, filter that information to be able to make more sense of it and, importantly, act on it. Not just act on it once and make citizen engagement something episodic and occasional, but a regular way of doing business. And we're seeing lots of examples like that. In my work in New Jersey, where I used to head AI for the state, we went out and used AI to sort through many, many databases. Again, this is just tools for recognizing patterns in data, and find 693,000 children who were entitled to a food benefit, people we had missed, we had dropped by accident. You know, they're James in this database and John in this one, to be able to sort through that data, find them, and to be able to deliver a better service. So I think the opportunity now to put AI, not in front, between the public servant and the public, but behind the public servant, to be able to do things like sort through data, make sense of more information, deliver better services, and do more engagement is really the exciting opportunity.
So when government is using different forms of AI to do those things, are they generally developing the AI themselves, or are they using commercially available platforms and applying them for a government or public interest purpose?
So I think your question, you know, is spot on in that in most cases, governments are the largest purchasers of technology all over the world. We already have contracts in government with many large technology providers. You know, we use Microsoft products in the Australian government, in most US governments. And so the initial uses of AI come from the addition of a bit of AI, you know, the Copilot add-on to the Microsoft tools people are already using. It's governments going out and purchasing access to a ChatGPT, a Claude, a Gemini. Many schools already use the Google Suite. And so it's the addition of those commercial models. That's like, you know, we use Microsoft Word in most of our institutions now, too. The question of what we do with Microsoft Word, are you writing a ransom note or are you writing a novel? That's really the big question. What do we do on top of these tools? But I think your question gets to what a lot of us are worried about, which is, you know, ceding control to tools that are not accountable to us, that are only accountable potentially to one overlord in Silicon Valley. So we are seeing governments move towards, number one, the use of more open source kinds of technology and even building their own tools. So the Spanish government has gone out and built its own large language model. So has Sweden, so has Estonia. I would say the governments aren't yet using those tools, but they are investing for research purposes in building their own large language models. Obviously, the Chinese government has done a lot of the same. But even without the need for, you know, building your own large language model, what we do on top of those are what's really the exciting thing. It is the 150 parents we worked with in California who don't speak English, who are low literacy, who went out and built their own AI tool, again, on top of one of those commercial models. This is the writing the novel with Microsoft Word. They went out and designed and built their own tool to help them navigate the process of receiving benefits from the state for their child with disabilities. It was a tool that ordinary people built for themselves, yes, using a commercial model, but the tool they built on top of it was free, open, inspectable, accountable, and again, designed for and by the public.
And I think some of those features that you just described are really at the heart of democratic AI, as you describe it, in Reboot AI and the Race to Save Democracy. Beth, I wonder if you could outline for us what, in your view, are the defects in modern democratic systems are and where you see the most potential of AI to remedy those defects.
How long is the show? We've got a lot of challenges, number one. And number two, democracy means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. For most people, when you say democracy, they're talking about elections, free, fair, and frequent elections. For other people, it's about the right to participate, right? So democracy is supposed to be government of, for, and by the people. Most of us would say, I don't really have that much influence around what happens either in my local council in Canberra, let alone in Washington or Brussels or some far off global thing. And then there are the issues really of government capacity, the ability of our democratic institutions, once we've elected people and put them in place and created, you know, government institutions, how good are they at solving problems? So in the book, I spend more time, obviously, on sort of unpacking these many different crises. Again, some worse in one place than in others. We have a significant problem, not with the actual subversion of our elections. Although I take that back now, increasing after a recent Supreme Court decision, we have actual subversion of our elections as well as the perception of the subversion of our elections in the U.S., more so than here. But I think everywhere, the twin challenges of our ability to participate and then the capacity of our institutions to really solve the problems that we're facing, you know, from climate to healthcare, to housing, you name it. We have a lot of challenges and we are not fast enough or good enough at solving them, I think is a sort of widely and universally held view. So what I'm trying to unpack is how we can really do a better job at solving problems in a way that actually engages the communities that are most affected.
On Sunday Extra, we are speaking with Professor Beth Novick, author of the book Reboot, AI and the Race to Save Democracy. Beth, at the very start of the book, you refer to your previous book, the 2010 title, Wiki Government, which was about the promise of digital technology for collaborative democracy. I wonder how much of that promise was realized in your view, and what implications do you think that has for the new promise that you see in AI for democracy?
So I've done a few earlier books about the promise of earlier technologies. I even have an earlier project called Democracy, the Video Game. I have looked in every generation. And by the way, Acme in Melbourne was has been very pathbreaking in thinking about how do we use video games for social cohesion and citizen engagement. One of the things we failed to appreciate, I think, is that it was so exciting at the advent of the web. You know, we were so excited about, we were giving everybody a megaphone. We could all start talking. And yes, we could all go out and make YouTube videos and record dances on TikTok. What I failed to appreciate, is that when everybody's talking, it becomes increasingly hard for anybody to listen. And when it comes to things like our institutions, whether it's governments or schools or hospitals or universities, institutions need the right information, frankly, for us in our community and as individuals. We need the right information in the right time so that we can make a decision and take action. When everybody is talking, and we've seen this on social media, we are drowning. We are awash in too much information and frankly, too much screaming. So that was, I think, the challenge we've had is to talk about not just talking, but listening. And what I'm excited about the potential for AI, and it's only potential, it's not necessarily probable, but it is a potential, is that we can use these tools that help us to synthesize, to summarize, to organize information, to help us do a better job at listening. And that's really the potential here. And that's the potential that I hope we're going to learn how to take advantage of. We're going to build the tools to help us to take advantage of. And we're going to, again, put to use so that we have that other side of the equation. Web helps us to talk. We're on the internet all talking all the time. But how do we filter, sort, organize that in a way to extract what we need to know to make better decisions?
Beth, you recently did a workshop through the Australian Public Service Academy with 30 Australian public servants about designing democratic engagement. And a big theme of that is using AI to help the government listen. To what extent do modern public services have the skills needed to use AI well to improve engagement?
So engagement, that is to say, going out and knowing how to ask a question, listen to and act on the answer, is frankly not a skill that any of us are taught. We're not taught it in school. We're not taught it in university. We're not taught it on the job. It's not something we necessarily know how to do. And there's a good reason for that. It's not by accident that we haven't been taught it, because it's frankly really difficult. It's difficult because the tools that have existed to date haven't been adequate to the task. If I go out and do a consultation and the UK government has gone out and asked this question, what does it cost us to analyze and summarize and synthesize what people have told us? And that is across, you know, the few hundred consultations that they do, you know, that is a £20 million expense. City of Hamburg, which I alluded to before, was spending 4 to 5 months to analyze. Anytime they went out and asked people, you know, you get a few comments back, you have to go out and make sense of it. When I worked for President Obama now umpteen years ago, we said to people, you know, what should be our policy for our first 100 days? Obama was pretty popular at that point. We got 125,000 suggestions. I don't need to tell you what we did with that. The answer is not much, because we didn't have the tools to help us to do it. So as a result, we haven't learned how to do this well, and we surely haven't learned how to do it well with AI. So that workshop accompanied a free program that is available online now called Democratic Engagement with AI that teaches some of these skills. But frankly, the most important skills are not, they don't have anything to do with AI. They're about asking, what's the question I'm trying to get an answer to? What am I going to do with that information once people get back to me? How am I going to act on it? We tend to do a lot of performative engagement, that is to say, asking people without a clear view about, oh, what am I actually going to do with what they tell me? How am I going to make sense of it? What am I going to use it for? So now with AI, again, that we have the opportunity to bring down the costs of doing that, we think it's a really good time to relearn or learn for the first time the skills of how do I go out and ask? Whom do I want to ask? What do I want to know from them? And importantly, what am I going to do with it once they tell me? Again, cheaper, faster, and easier. So it's time for us to learn, I think, how do we go out and do that in much the same way that we have to learn the skills and have had to relearn the skills. What do you do when you go to the doctor? How do you go on the internet and look up the questions you now want to ask about your medical condition, take those to the doctor in an easy and efficient way so that you can both leverage the technology and leverage the expert you have in front of you? Perhaps that's a helpful analogy for just understanding how we all need to relearn the way that we work, especially in ways that are more engaged.
You said earlier that AI that's democratic should be open source as well. In a world where we know that the most prominent AI services are provided by privately owned corporate services, how feasible do you think it is for government scale AI to be genuinely open source, and what security or other risks might come with a model like that?
Because we want to ensure that the AI that we're using protects our privacy, protects the privacy of our data, many institutions are moving towards contracting for AI that is more secure, that doesn't train on the information that we put into it. It's why you see the government here rolling out their own AI, what we might call sandbox or AI assistant, GovAI tool, so that people aren't just typing things into a free platform. You know, states like South Australia are rolling out what they call SAI. In my work in New Jersey, we created what we called our AI assistant. That is to say, we signed terms of service which said we want to ensure there is privacy for the data that we type into these tools. That's not dissimilar to any of the tools that we would use in a government, in a school, in a bank, in an insurance company. What those tools are that we use is, I think, an evolving matter. So what's exciting about AI and with some of these AI sandboxes or these AI assistants is that when I type in an instruction now, it's called a prompt, the AI itself can start to help us make a decision about which AI tool should I use. Do I need a ChatGPT or a Claude or one of these very large language models, or might I use a smaller, more energy efficient, more water efficient, or open source alternative? So the best of these sandboxes or assistants give people access to multiple models. If for no other reason, then frankly, I want to be able to test out who gives me a better answer to my question. Do I like the way that Claude writes or Gemini or ChatGPT or something else? I think what we've seen over the years is that open source tools are actually, generally speaking, the more secure alternative because they are inspectable, because we know what goes into them. But importantly with AI, we also have to know what comes out of them. They perform differently. When you type in something to ChatGPT, you get two different answers. You know, I ask it to write a poem, it'll give me two different poems, depending on, you know, the time of day and the day of the week. That's just the nature of how these tools work. So I think having access to multiple tools, the ability to experiment with multiple tools, and to move towards tools where we have better evidence of how they work, both from a security perspective, but also to ensure that they're just more effective, I think is going to be a really important evolution in how our institutions acquire and use and contract for technology.
We recently saw the examples of various AI models escaping their sandboxes and not only accessing the internet, but actually hacking other organizations to get an answer, and in some cases, even hiding their tracks. Is there any way of avoiding those risks for an open source, publicly owned AI as well?
So we're seeing, of course, as we have in every age, a sort of arms race with technology. And this is a constant challenge for institutions where there are threats and then there are responses to those threats, where you have an intrusion and then you have the frantic effort to kind of patch and secure and bolster the technology to resist that intrusion. The exciting thing is that because we are using AI tools, or the exciting potential is these tools help us to build technology faster. We can code faster and create software faster. The very same tools that are being used for hacking and intrusion are also helping the good guys to defend against those intrusions. So very important in this process is not simply the technology, it's the communication among industry and governments. It's the sharing of data and information about those intrusions. What are you seeing? What are we seeing? What are the risks? So that people can share that patching, as it's called, or those security updates. They're coming fast and furiously. It's not the case where now you can say, oh, I'm going to schedule that update, you know, 3 weeks from now because I know there's a vulnerability. That is now a very daily occurrence. Again, we're getting better at it, but it's not an issue of open source versus closed source simply. This has to do with, again, how we communicate, how we share those lessons. And that's why you see these companies coming out and saying, hey, there's a risk. sharing that information. And that's really what's paramount here. There does need to be regulation. There does need to be testing. There does need to be greater security to ensure that we know how these things behave and that we get faster. But the exciting thing is that we're seeing the also uses of AI and investments in AI to help us get better at protecting ourselves. But this arms race against the bad guys, that is nothing new. And it's one that we've been fighting for a long time. It is getting faster and it is getting harder. But again, it's all the more reason that we need more openness, more accountability. It's not an issue of just does the government build it? Does a company build it? Again, depends on who the government is, whether we're going to trust them more or we're going to trust a company more. But it does have to do with whether those tools are open, accountable, transparent, well-tested, and tested not just for what's going in, but also what's coming out and how they behave over time.
Professor Beth Novak, thank you so much for joining us on Sunday Extra.
Thank you for having me.
And Beth Novak is director of the Burns Center for Social Change at Northeastern University and also currently an Australian Resilient Democracy Fellow. Professor Novak's new book is Reboot: AI and the Race to Save Democracy.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.